I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congressional leaders have ended a month-long stalemate over an overhaul of the nation's intelligence bureaucracy. The breakthrough came when renegade Republicans were reassured about the role of the Pentagon, and final House and Senate votes will likely come today or tomorrow. The bill will enact many of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, including the creation of a national intelligence director to oversee all spy agencies. Well, meanwhile, the New York Times reports today on two recent leaked CIA assessments on the U.S. effort in Iraq, which present a very grim projection for the security and economic stability of that country. Douglas Jell has the exclusive report. He joins us now from Washington. And Doug, these two reports, who are they from?
One was a cable written by the outgoing station chief in Baghdad. The second were briefings provided by a senior CIA official, Michael Costi, who just returned from a trip to Iraq.
And what do these reports say?
They say the situation is bad, it's getting worse, and it may not rebound anytime soon.
And do we know the source further of these reports? For instance, the Baghdad CIA station chief, is it known who he is? Is it reliable?
His name is not public. He works undercover, and his name cannot be published by law. He's a highly regarded official who took charge of that station a year ago, and it's a big operation. It's the largest CIA station overseas in Saigon during Vietnam.
So you say a bleak assessment from his report and also from another, but we've heard bleak reports recently. What is different and new here?
I think what is new is that this is a report drafted just in the last several weeks after the victory in Fallujah, what was portrayed as a victory by military commanders, that is another dose of reality or pessimism, if you will, about the chances for turning the tide in Iraq, diminishing the violence there.
Mm. What's been the reaction to the report?
Well, because this is a classified document, people are very guarded in what they'll say about it. The White House and the CIA will not comment on these documents. We do know that the ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte, and the top American commander there, General Casey, both had an opportunity to comment. And Ambassador Negroponte, at least, dissented and suggested that the situation wasn't as bad as the CIA station chief had portrayed.
Mm. And we also know that Senator John McCain and others are complaining that that CIA agents and CIA operatives are leaking these intelligence reports to undermine the presidency.
That's right. Senator McCain has criticized the CIA, called it a rogue agency, suggesting that that it is going after the president. CIA officials, including John McLaughlin, the number two there, have objected in strong terms to that characterization. They say the job of the CIA is to tell the truth, to be independent, to state the facts as they see them, and that it would be a mistake to suppress that independence.
Right. And tell us some more of what the reports say. I mean, obviously there's an overarching grimness to them, but are there specifics that they point to?
There are specifics. There are mentions of progress. They note that Iraq is, against some formidable odds, making progress in the development of a political process. And they credit Iraqis for their resiliency in the face of violence. But they say that this violence may well continue to get worse unless the Iraqi government makes progress soon in asserting its authority nationwide and in promoting economic growth.
Mm. And these reports are leaked as we have a new head of the CIA, Porter Goss, who wrote a memo internally asking agents to keep intelligence in the family. What does it say to you that these have been leaked so soon after that memo?
That's a difficult question to answer. Certainly, Mr. Goss's memo could be read in two ways. He told agency employees that their job was to support the administration and its policies, but also that their job was to present the facts as they see them. I think that the station chief and the officials who are willing to describe his memo believe that this presentation of the facts is important, and that the American public ought to hear that voice, which is, as we've said, a more pessimistic one than we've heard from the Bush administration.
Douglas Jell, correspondent for the New York Times. His reports on leaked CIA reports are in today's paper. Douglas, thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Well, two reporters, Judith Miller of The New York Times and Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, could soon be sent to prison for as much as a year and a half for refusing to reveal what they know about last year's outing of an undercover CIA agent. Neither journalist actually reported the agent's name, and it's not clear if it was even leaked to them. But they were working on the story, and they head to court tomorrow to appeal prison sentences they received for refusing to name a source. Joining us on the line first, Amy Sullivan, an editor at Washington Monthly Magazine. She writes about the investigation in this month's edition of that magazine. And Amy, remind us, this is the case of CIA agent Valerie Plame, wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. When was her name leaked to the press?
Her name was leaked sometime in July of 2003. There's about a week span in between when her husband, Joseph Wilson, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times kind of criticizing the White House's take on their rationale for leading into war with Iraq. And then a week later when Robert Novak published a column naming Valerie Plame as Joe Wilson's wife.
And remind us, Joseph Wilson felt he knew a bit of something about that matter because...
Well, the CIA had sent him to Niger to investigate a claim that the Iraqi government had attempted to purchase uranium there, which would have been pretty key in terms of their ability to develop weapons of mass destruction. Joe Wilson went there, poked around, and determined that, in fact, there had been no such attempted sale. He came back, says that he told the CIA this, and that report then went to the White House. And yet, it was the following year when the president had the infamous sort of 16 words in his State of the Union address saying that, in fact, Iraq had attempted to buy this uranium.
Now, you mentioned columnist Robert Novak. He was the only journalist to actually print the name of Valerie Plame. What was the context?
Well, what he said in his column was that you couldn't necessarily trust what Joe Wilson said because he wasn't just some independent guy who'd been sent over to Niger to represent the administration. But in fact, the request from the CIA had come because his wife was an undercover agent for the CIA and had suggested that he be the one who was sent over. Okay. He was basically implying that it was just a case of nepotism, that Wilson wasn't necessarily qualified to be doing this, and therefore we shouldn't really believe his report.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a hue and cry ensued with two very separate issues. One, the legality of someone leaking the name of a CIA agent. The other, the illegality or ethical nature of a reporter actually printing it. And where did the story go from there? Was there an investigation launched then?
Well, it's kind of interesting because Novak's column came out, and there was a cry from some corners, but mostly focused on the administration and whether it was appropriate or even, as you say, legal for them to reveal the identity of an undercover agent. And then it sort of quieted down, and we didn't hear anything for almost 2 months until the Justice Department announced that they were launching an investigation into who leaked that name. And it's important to note that this is the only independent investigation that has been launched under the Bush administration so far.
And what has happened during this investigation? What do we know?
Well, we don't know a heck of a lot. And one of the reasons for that is that the investigator, Patrick Fitzgerald, isn't saying much. In fact, we know mostly what's happened because the people who have talked to him then turn around and either directly or through their lawyers say publicly what has happened.
Well, tell us, who has been called before the grand jury investigation and what do we know from them?
We know that about half a dozen reporters have been called to talk and are in different stages of either agreeing to cooperate and in some cases have been released from a confidentiality agreement by some of their sources who have said, it's okay, you can go ahead and tell them what we talked about.
Because, in fact, in those cases, it's assumed the name was not leaked in those conversations.
Exactly, exactly. Although Matthew Cooper of Time Magazine and Judith Miller of New York Times, they have refused to talk about their sources. And in Miller's case, at least, she was released from her confidentiality agreement, and she's still refusing to talk because she says on principle she thinks that anybody who releases themselves from such an agreement in an investigation is actually being pressured to do so and that it's not sort of a voluntary decision there.
We're going to talk more in a moment about the questions raised about the reporter's responsibility in this case. But what is the legal responsibility of the person who leaked the name? That's what the Independent Counsel investigation is trying to get at. Is it illegal to leak the name of a CIA agent?
It seems to be, yes. What we know is that it's not necessarily the act of giving it to a reporter who will then make it public. It is illegal for a federal employee to reveal the identity to someone outside the government of an undercover agent.
And so do we have any sense that the investigation is getting any closer to who the leaker might be?
You know, we really don't. You would think a year into the investigation that they would be fairly close. And some of the people I talked to when I first started working on this story said that they just thought it was inconceivable that Robert Novak hadn't already talked to the investigators and told them what he knew about his sources, because it'd been this long, and how could they have waited that long to go to the guy who's really at the center? I have to say, we really have no way of knowing one way or the other where the investigation is at this point.
But, you know, they just leave, there's this huge vacuum where there's all these questions and very little answers, because, you know, the sense would be, well, wait a second, two reporters are potentially going to serve jail time, and they didn't print the name.
Exactly.
Robert Novak did print the name, presumably knows the source, mm-hmm. and, as far as we know, has escaped the threat of prison time.
Well, that's kind of the interesting thing, is we have no idea what's going on with him, for the simple reason that he's refusing to talk. He's refusing to talk publicly. We have no idea if he's talked to the investigator. But while Cooper and Miller have both kind of let us know where they are in the process, and certainly we know that they are on the brink of facing prison time, we have absolutely no idea what Robert Novak has been up to. And he has made it very clear to his colleagues in the press that if they bring up the issue, he will refuse to talk about it. You know, he's executive producer of the Capital Gang, and some of his colleagues there told me that they know better than to bring it up. He simply won't talk about it, and he's in charge. He gets to decide what issues they discuss, and he has decided that they will not discuss this.
Amy Sullivan is an editor at the Washington Monthly. Her story about trying to get Robert Novak to discuss this very issue appears in the Washington Monthly. Amy, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And when we come back, other questions raised in this case. Should reporters have the right to grant confidentiality? Should they have different rights than ordinary citizens? Should different reporters have different rights? Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our discussion of the Independent Counsel investigation into who leaked the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame. Now, two journalists, Judith Miller of The New York Times and Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, could end up in prison for refusing to tell a grand jury what they know in the case, even though they never reported the agent's name. The case heads to an appeals court tomorrow. They'll be there. We turn now to Lucy Dalglish, executive director for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. They've filed a friend of the court brief backing reporters Cooper and Miller. Hi, Lucy.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Jeffrey Stone, professor of law at the University of Chicago. Hello, professor.
Delighted to be here.
Tell us what the legality is. Lucy, why then are Judith Miller and Matt Cooper potentially going to prison?
Well, in a journalist's mind, they have an ethical obligation to keep their promises. And although they don't do it often as a rule, when they make a promise to keep a source confidential, they keep the source's name confidential.
But we should clarify, is this law or practice?
Well, for journalists, it is practice. And in many states, 31 states in the District of Columbia, the law generally supports their right to do that. However, the law does not specifically allow them to do that in the federal court system. For 30 years, there have been court decisions that in the federal system that have appeared to provide certain levels of protection for journalists and their sources. But in the last year and a half to 2 years, federal court judges have been much less likely to recognize that privilege, particularly in a grand jury context where they're investigating a crime.
Yeah, and I want to ask both of you, start with you, Lucy, do you think Judith Miller and Matt Cooper will go to jail?
I think there's a very good chance that that's going to happen. I know that their attorneys are going to give it a really good shot tomorrow in court and try to persuade the D.C. Circuit that this is an important First Amendment-based legal principle as well as a common law principle that, you know, the court should recognize what is practice in the journalism field. I am not expecting the D.C. Circuit to come out with any groundbreaking privilege in a grand jury context. So I think ultimately what's going to happen is those two reporters may go to jail. It's possible they'll appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I really don't know what their lawyers' thinking is.
Well, Professor Stone, I know you think you also think they might go to jail. What do you think about that? Now, reporters will say there can be no whistleblowers, no watchdogs on the government, no one willing to call their companies on the carpet unless those people are allowed confidentiality. It's a time-honored tradition. But do you think that it should be a blanket tradition? Do you think there should be restrictions on it? You know, the idea of keeping confidentiality with a source.
Well, the first problem right now is that there is no recognized legal right that would govern the reporters in this situation. That is, there's no federal statute that covers them. The Supreme Court has, for the most part, rejected any significant First Amendment argument about a right. So the difficulty that they've created is by offering promises of confidentiality in circumstances in which they have no legal right to keep those promises. And that's what really creates the immediate problem.
Well, second
question is I do believe that there should be a privilege. And I think that the laws that most states have adequately would protect the privilege, and that there should be a federal statute that recognizes that. The problem is it doesn't exist, and reporters, like the rest of us, ultimately must comply with the law.
Well, and Lucy, some people say that in this case in particular, the reporters should have blown the whistle on the person, perhaps from the White House, who was about to leak a CIA agent's name, that their obligation isn't with protecting that source, but revealing them.
Well, you know, the problem with being a reporter is that you're not always privileged to know exactly what's going on in all of these places. I don't know that these reporters at the time they got that information were in a position to say, hey, wait a minute, the law is being broken here. Usually that's not the way it works.
Well, but in fact, most reporters seem to be doing that because Robert Novak was the only one who printed it.
Well, they also were making a judgment on whether or not it was a story and whether or not it was an important story or an interesting story. And it also appeared that I think in this particular case, it appeared to many of them that someone in the White House was just trying to get Wilson, and they probably thought, well, you know, that's just political game playing, and they didn't want to get into it. The problem is you're not, you know, you can't make exceptions when you're a reporter for, well, it's political game playing, it's breaking the law, or this is an important public policy story.
Some would say, well, doesn't that, you know, beg the question, who gets to decide? Robert Novak, for instance, recently said on one of his shows that he thought that CBS should reveal the source for the documents that led to the discussion of President Bush's National Guard. So he would have wanted those revealed, but obviously he doesn't want to reveal his source when he named Valerie Plame. Who decides?
The privilege, to the extent it exists, belongs ultimately to the source, not to protect the reporter. It's to protect the source and to encourage the source to be candid. That's actually very important because, in my view, under even the broadest version of a privilege, it should not apply in this particular situation. The White House officials who allegedly gave this information were not providing any information of any significant public interest. They were simply violating the federal statute, outing a CIA agent for partisan political purposes. That's not the kind of disclosure that we want to encourage. Indeed, it's the kind of disclosure that's criminal under the federal criminal law. And therefore, even if we had an absolute privilege, my view is that it still would not apply in this situation, in the same way that if someone goes to an attorney and seeks legal advice not for the purpose of acting in compliance with the law, but for the purpose of committing a fraud, the attorney-client privilege doesn't apply.
So, Lucy Dauglish, we have a situation here where two reporters might go to jail who may or may not have been leaked the name, just are refusing to even discuss that. And they may go to jail ahead of someone who did leak a CIA agent's name, and that's a federal crime.
Yeah, I think it's possible that not only will they be going to jail ahead of the actual source, I think they may be going to jail instead of the actual source.
Lucy Dauglish is Executive Director for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Lucy, thank you.
You're very welcome.
We also spoke with Professor Jeffrey Stone, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much.
My pleasure for being here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hamid Karzai was sworn in today in the restored hall of the former royal palace in Kabul, becoming the first popularly elected president of Afghanistan. In his inaugural address, Karzai pledged to crack down on the growing drug trade, increase the standard of living, and continue to fight armed militias. Vice President Dick Cheney attended the ceremony and urged Afghanistan to keep up the pressure on the war on terrorism.
Now the tyranny is gone. The terrorist enemy is scattered, and the people of Afghanistan are free.
Well, today's inauguration marked the culmination of a three-year campaign to transform Afghanistan from an al-Qaeda training ground into a moderate Islamic state. Afghanistan has already adopted a new constitution, which the U.S. says is the most progressive in the region, but there are still serious concerns about it. Joining us now is Preeta Bansal. She's the chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a federal agency set up to monitor religious rights around the world. And Preeta, what are some of your concerns about the Afghan constitution and its ability to protect religious freedom?
First of all, there's a real problem in the Afghan constitution, and there's a real problem in the Afghan constitution in the sense that the state has the ability to impose its interpretation of Islam, and it's usually interpreted through this hardliner who's the Chief Justice of the Afghan Supreme Court, who we happened to meet when we were in Afghanistan, and he gave us some very provocative statements as we were meeting with him.
Such as?
He told us that they didn't need a constitution because they had a constitution, and he was thumping and pointing at his Quran that was on his desk. Yeah. And he went on to say, by the way, you know, I agree with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all except for three provisions. And we said, which are those three? And he said the freedom of speech, the freedom of conscience, and the rights of women. And this is a man who imposed a death sentence of execution on a woman of at the time who was a minister in the government simply because she criticized political statements and certain things about what Islam required.
Well, what are the main problems with the Afghan constitution that allow a judge to make such drastic decisions?
There's no protection for individual rights of conscience and belief. The religious freedom clause there basically provides freedom for non-Muslims to worship. And that's a very, very narrow and, we think, flawed conception of religious freedom. Because in Afghanistan, 99% of the population is Muslim. It's not just about protecting the rights of the 1%. It's about protecting the individual rights of Muslims to believe something different from what a state-imposed orthodoxy may require. Like, you know, you may have the Chief Justice in Afghanistan telling you that Islam requires you to do this. But there may be an individual Muslim who believes that Islam may not require that. Mm-hmm. So the problem when you have these kind of state-imposed orthodoxies and no individual right of conscience is that you don't really provide the breathing space necessary for alternative voices to emerge within a particular tradition.
Now, I understand that the Afghan constitution does make reference to international documents that do protect human rights. Doesn't that language provide protection for freedom of religion?
First of all, that's in the preamble. It's a preamble clause. It makes reference to them. But I think the biggest problem with the Afghanistan constitution, it's threefold. First of all, it says that all of the individual human rights guarantees can be trumped by ordinary law. So even like something as basic as the right to life, for example, it says everyone has the right to life except as provided by law.
I'm wondering if a potential problem could be that some hamlet might decide to install Sharia or strict Islamic law, and in their view, that law would trump any rights granted in a constitution.
As I read the constitutional provision, that's certainly possible. It says you have all these rights except as provided by law. And then it goes on to say that all law must be in conformity with Islam. And then it says that how you interpret whether or not a law is in conformity with Islam, the Supreme Court will determine that.
Well, this constitution in Afghanistan was drafted under U.S. watch. Some might say, why didn't the U.S. or members of the international community ensure that the constitution was written in a way that would protect individual rights?
The United Nations played a role in terms of technical assistance and otherwise, but it was very much the Afghan people. And I think the United States took largely a hands-off attitude with respect to the Afghan constitution, and especially the religious freedom guarantees. And we, our commission has pushed hard for that mistake not to be repeated in Iraq.
Well, let's now talk about the Iraqi constitution. There's currently a temporary constitution in place in Iraq. But if the elections take place in January as planned, the first job of the new government will be to draft a new constitution. What are the guarantees that the same problems that we're seeing in the Afghan constitution won't occur in the Iraqi constitution?
There are no guarantees, ultimately. I mean, you have to struggle for each new step. But the Iraq transitional administrative law does have language in there, the Afghan constitution does not, about the right of the individual right of freedom of conscience. And we think that's a very important development.
And you'll think that'll stay?
We're certainly hopeful, but, it's a whole new game. Once the elections happen in Iraq, the new legislature is elected, they decide their constitution.
Can you just tell us some of the other ways that you're concerned that religious rights are being violated in Iraq?
One of the things that concerns us a lot is these extrajudicial Islamic courts that are out there and in the various cities and the various provinces. I mean, there's a significant number of Iraqis, and in Najaf alone, I think there are like 300, who've been forcibly tried in front of these extrajudicial tribunals and other religious clerics. And some of these religious courts are passing death sentences on, Muslim Iraqis accused of cooperating with coalition forces. So they're kind of using religion as, again, declaring un-Islamic certain activities that they don't like. This is about the rights of Muslims as well as non-Muslims. It's about religious freedom is about protecting individual rights of conscience. And, in fact, in Fallujah now, just in the last couple days, there have been women executed and really brutally kind of displayed on the streets with their entrails taken out. I mean, really gruesomely as kind of examples of what women who are not properly attired with the full kind of Afghan-style burqa, what will happen to them. So, I mean, this is the imposition of religious law and a certain interpretation of what's required in these religious codes.
It's interesting because it's the intersection of religion and violent crime.
It's the use of religion to stifle political dissent.
And it doesn't feel, even though I know you're concerned about the Constitution and how it's worded, it doesn't feel as if, in the short term anyway, anything the Constitution says is going to matter.
That was part of what we heard when we were pushing in Afghanistan. Honestly, some of the pushback we got was that, well, it's really just a piece of paper. There's so many problems in Afghanistan. The Constitution is like the least of the things we want to like use our capital on. But at the end of the day, the Constitution matters because it's an aspirational document. It sets out a society's values. It may not have immediate impact the moment it goes, it's signed into force. But it ultimately provides a hook that generations later or, decades later, you can draw upon to push your ideals in society. I mean, we certainly have seen that in our own constitutional development in this country. We certainly did not meet all of our constitutional ideals at our founding, but it has become a tool and an evocation of certain ideals that grow with time, with meaning. Unfortunately, if you start off a constitution and you start off a nation at its inception saying that people don't have certain rights and enshrining that into a foundational document, it's a very, very bad start.
Preeta Bansal is chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Preeta, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, we speak to an author who lived with Catholic nuns in America to tell and try to understand their story. You're listening to Here and Now. Twelve soldiers who were kicked out of the military after revealing that they were gay are challenging the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in federal court. The lawsuit cites a Supreme Court case that overturned Texas laws, which classified sodomy as a crime. The 11-year-old Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy allows gays to serve in the military as long as they keep their sexual orientation a secret and abstain from same-sex activities. Well, joining us is former U.S. Army Specialist Thomas Cook. He was discharged from the Army after telling his commander that he was gay. Welcome, Thomas.
How are you?
Fine. And also on the line, we have Sharon Alexander of the Service Members Legal Defense Network. She's participating. But, Thomas, I want to start with you. What led you to tell your commander about your sexual orientation in the first place?
A sergeant of mine, we went to the field, and we had noticed somebody that was gay walking by. And when he noticed that, he said that if anybody on his team was gay, he would kill them.
And here you were on his team.
Yes, and I was on his team. And worried for my safety, I went to my commander and outed myself.
Well, now, some would say you could have just gone to your commander and said, you know, somebody I work with made this threatening statement about someone else who we all know is gay. You didn't have to say that you were.
They would have investigated that, and I could have faced UCMJ action if they would have found out I was gay.
Right, that you had not told all the truth. And were you afraid for your safety?
Yes, I was, or else I wouldn't have said anything at all.
Yeah, you were about to be deployed to Iraq with this soldier who had just said he would kill someone if he thought they were gay.
Yes.
Right. We understand that the military responded to you that they thought you just said this to get out of going to Iraq. Your thoughts?
That's what they had said, but a year before that, I had volunteered to go to Kuwait and to fight an intransitive action.
Why did you decide to participate in this suit?
Because I'm an American, too, and I believe that I should have the right to serve in my country no matter what my sexuality is.
Well, I want to turn now to Sharon Alexander. She's a lawyer at the Service Members Legal Defense Fund. Sharon, there have been two other lawsuits filed protesting the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. How are they different from this one that Thomas and 11 other soldiers have joined in?
It's different, really, just in a couple of ways. There's two other cases, as you said, that are floating around out there. There was one that was filed in October by the Log Cabin Republicans, which is an associational suit brought on behalf of Log Cabin Republicans and their members. There's one other suit out there where Don't Ask, Don't Tell challenges a tangential claim. It's sort of a side claim. It's not the center of the suit, but it came up as part of the suit, so there's a claim made there as well. Our suit is about 12 individual people, all of whom were separated from the service because of their sexual orientation, and all of whom want very badly to go back in and serve. So I guess the upshot of our suit is that it's 12 real people with 12 real discharges who very much want to go back in.
Right. Well, Thomas, I'm not going to ask you to debate again the premise of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and homosexuality in the military. As you well know, members of the military, there are some who feel that it's an issue they don't want to have to deal with when they're on the battlefield. Obviously, you feel otherwise. This is a part of who you are. But some would say, why bring this issue up now when there's already a feeling of a backlash in the country against gay issues, gay marriage in particular? Why not wait?
I would let my lawyer answer that question.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not really a matter of a good time or a bad time, I would argue. Our 12 plaintiffs are all coming up against statutes of limitation, and if they all want to get back in, they need to challenge this law soon. And beyond that, I would say that when our country is in a time of war, when we are desperate for people, no matter how you feel about the global war on terrorism, the fact of the matter is that the Army in particular is really looking for good people. We should not be firing people for this whole reason that they are gay. And these are 12 qualified people who've served and served well in the past and are ready to do so again.
And Thomas Cook, what was that like for you to have to, you know, hide your sexuality while in service?
That actually is really hard because there's so many so many people that confide in you and try to tell you stuff, but yet you can't confide in them and actually tell them the truth because you're afraid that you could get court-martialed and get kicked out and possibly spend time in Leavenworth.
Do you wish you were in Iraq?
Yes, I do. I talk to my friends in Iraq nearly every single day via email. And it's the same people that I worked with, and they wish I was there, too, just as much as I wish I was there.
And do you know of other men in the military who were maybe in your unit who are also keeping a secret?
I know of plenty of people in my unit that are.
Thomas Cook, a former U.S. Army specialist, he's a plaintiff in a federal lawsuit challenging the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. We also spoke to Sharon Alexander of the Service Members Legal Defense Network. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here at... I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In 1965, there were 180,000 Catholic nuns in the United States. Today, that number has dropped to 73,000. Little attention has been paid to this vanishing subculture. Cloistered nuns are hard to observe, and nuns who aren't cloistered are hard to detect. Only one in three wears a habit now. Who are these women, these sisters, who have given up sex, money, often any relationship outside of an order, to dedicate their lives to God? Well, when investigative journalist Cheryl Reed was a little girl, she was afraid of nuns, but fascinated by them. She turned that curiosity into a book, Unveiled, The Hidden Lives of Nuns, and she joined us in the studio to talk about the 5 years she spent getting to know hundreds of sisters in over 50 orders and communities across the country, and also to explain her fascination with nuns.
Growing up Protestant, I never met a nun. I never saw a nun other than on the street or at a gas station. And they were stern-looking because to people who aren't used to nuns in the habit, the habit can be a pretty scary dress.
Yeah, when the wind catches it. It is. It's sort of it's dark and spooky. What is it? What does it signify?
Well, typically today, what a habit signifies is that typically that order is a little more conservative and more traditional. The orders that are progressive kind of broke away from the habit. They wear little pins. Some of the older sisters will still wear a habit. But generally, anyone below 70 or even 80 these days will not wear a habit.
It was at one time the wedding gown?
And it still is to some sisters.
In the marriage to Christ?
Yes. And I have been to some of those ceremonies, and it does look like a wedding. And they do march down the aisle with a candle, and their habit is blessed, and then they put it on. So it's a very romantic notion. And initially, when they first got their habits, they adored them. They loved them. They prayed little vigils for every little piece. But then after a while, they got tired of this thing, and they really were looking forward to getting rid of it.
Well, now you're meeting nuns. I'm thinking of one, Pat, who wears a red slip.
Yeah.
Because she can.
Right.
And so I know you started this pilgrimage of your own to find out why women like Pat and others became nuns. Why did they?
There are several different reasons. One is that we're talking generations. Like in the 1940s and the 1950s, some of these women had very little opportunities. They could either become a nun, they could marry and have lots of kids, particularly if they're a Catholic, or they could become a teacher. And for many of them who grew up in large families, particularly those who lived in rural communities, going to the convent basically was the only way they could get an education. That's the sort of the old model. The newer models, and the average age for the women entering today is 38. So the newer models are typically two different categories. One is a younger woman, typically in the early 20s, who is very conservative, wants the habit, wants the traditional lifestyle, and those orders are actually getting numbers of women. And then there's a second kind of woman entering today, and she's typically older, very educated, has had a successful career. A third of them have been married and have many of them have adult children. And those women, they feel like they've achieved everything the world said was valuable, and yet they weren't happy. And they feel that they want to give their lives to something of a higher calling. They want their work to mean something. And most importantly, they want to live with other women.
Yeah. You came across so many types of these women as well, some very social, some hermits, some conservative, others like I'm thinking of Benedictine Mother Superior Dawn, into Star Trek.
The Mystic Mother Superior.
Yes. And some activist, Sister Margaret Traxler in Chicago, ran in homeless shelters, you became very close to her.
I did. I spent often on the last 2 years of her life with her. She was a very controversial figure in the larger Catholic Church and also in Chicago. She put her name when an ad ran in the New York Times in 1984 in support of Geraldine Ferraro, saying that there are other Catholics who believe in abortion. So this ad ran, 96 nuns signed their names and several priests. The priests were told to recant, which they did. The nuns refused. And she was one of those nuns, and she was very much pressured by the Vatican to recant by what she said, and she never would.
Yeah. This woman in particular, I mean, I think as a whole they all touched you, but this woman mm-hmm. in particular did. How? Why?
I think there's this perception that if you're a religious woman, that you are a pushover, that you're meek and mild, and you're the church lady. And and she was not the church lady. I mean, she would just tell you what she thought.
Until she couldn't.
Until she couldn't. You know, when she had a stroke, you know, it sort of robbed her of the most important vehicle that she had, which was speaking.
Yeah.
I think what she said to me, which in her impact on me, was that in order to be a spiritual person, you don't have to give up your own conscience. You don't have to be a meek and mild person. And in fact, a really strong, devoted, passionate person speaks up.
I say this person touched you, and I was joking with you before we started speaking here that we almost lost you. You, for a while, you're married. Here you are, tough investigative reporter. And suddenly looking at your subject and thinking maybe you wanted to do this.
I always went through it with the idea that I knew that the normal woman could not do this. And I sort of saw myself as a spiritual connoisseur, that I was testing out each of these religious orders, trying to figure out, could I really do this? It was sort of a test of wills. Could the modern woman really do this? And also I think it was to discover whether I really had it. I could tell you I could do it, but I'm not sure I want to do it. Mm-hmm. And there would be certain criteria. I adored living with these women. There's just this camaraderie that you don't experience anywhere else.
Yeah. You even at one point adopted their way of dressing, very simply black pants, yes, white shirt, to as you are now, come to think of it, to feel it, to try mm-hmm. to feel it. But, you know, the thing that swirls around everyone is they think maybe they could be deeply spiritual for their life, but mm-hmm. chastity. Do they talk to you about sex? Yeah.
All the time. In fact, they talk about sex a lot. And they talk about how they try to avoid those feelings and things like that and what they do when they get their days that they're really, you know, sexed up, you know.
Wait, did a nun actually use that phrase with you?
No, actually she said horny, but I don't know if we can say that on air. Anyway, when they get those days, they talk about it. They go play tennis. They try to share it with each other. Hmm. And then there are some orders that you're not allowed to talk about it. But increasingly, women are encouraged to talk about it because it's one way of relieving that stress and knowing that other women are going through it.
You wrote your book and spent your 5 years doing this research before mm-hmm. the current crisis in the Catholic Church.
Yeah. I actually worked for a year before I started this project. I spent a year traveling around the country and actually did several pieces on Boston priests. These were priests who had left the church and were married, some of them secretly, some of them openly, and they lost their pensions and support from the church. And so I spent a year doing this, traveling around the country, and so I knew a lot of priests. I found them to be very lonely, many of them. Mm. And I expected to find the same things when I turned my attention to the nuns, and that's not what I found. Actually, I found them to be very happy and very satisfied. Mm. So when the priest pedophilia stuff broke, largely in Boston and other areas, the sisters felt that they were kind of getting a black eye because they really are totally separate from the hierarchy of the church. The church does not support them. They don't give them money. They don't give them land, retirement. They're really their own entity. They do have to have their institutions okayed by the Vatican, but largely that's just a bureaucratic process.
This may seem too simple and a conclusion, but it sounds as if the Catholic Church isn't playing to its strengths.
Oh, absolutely, which is at the ending of my book, as I say, this is the secret church that the church could really build on, but they're not interested in hearing about women.
Well, Cheryl Reed, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Reed is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Her new book is called Unveiled, The Hidden Lives of Nuns.
Here
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.